Terry Blaser, and here we are again with Professor Bill Nyman. Hello, Bill, from California.
Hi, Harry. Good to talk to you again, as always.
So, Bill, today we're going to kind of complete the cycle and talk about pigs, poultry, sheep, and goat. And rumor has it you know at least a little bit about all of those. Let's start with pigs. So before that, tell me, what are the different companies you were associated with in your life?
Well, before we go into that, when you mentioned pigs, I had a trip down memory lane for our visit to that farm in Iowa where we were together in the early 90s and maybe mid-90s, I can't remember. But that was a great trip, and I hope you have good memories of it the same way I do. But in answer to your question, that was the Nyman Ranch days. We were on a field trip for Nyman Ranch, Harry's Farmers Market in Atlanta being our biggest customer. And you were in the process of doing your due diligence and understanding your supply chain while we were visiting that pig farm, one of many, in Corn Belt. And that was Nyman Ranch, which was a company I founded in, well, it actually began in the mid-70s. Started out as Nyman Shell Ranch, and then in the mid-90s, it became Nyman Ranch. And Orville, my partner at the time, prior to that, moved on to his wife and now is direct from the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. Now he's one of the co-directors of the Asia Society in New York. But fast forward to 2007, I decided to leave Nyman Ranch after several rounds of capital raises and having to partner with some meat industry people, and the ethos of the company changed significantly, and I was no longer comfortable there and decided that it was time for me, as we discussed in our previous visit, focus on grass-fed beef and really prove that grass-fed beef could be every bit as good as grain-finished beef, which was the Nyman Ranch paradigm at the time. And so roughly 2007, I founded a company called BN Ranch, which actually stood for Bill and Nicolette, not Bill Nyman. We left that up to the consumer to think about, Nicolette being my wife. And we focused on grass-fed beef. We just continued the development of that, our business model in the beef side, and also started raising heritage turkeys. So we began a breeding flock of heritage turkeys, and over the last few years, we got up to almost 20,000 birds per year produced from that flock, and they were sold direct to consumers as well as to specialty retailers and food service institutions. And March of 2016, that business was sold to Blue Apron. I had been working with them for several years to pioneer a very robust supply chain for grass-fed beef and outdoor-raised poultry and pigs. And we were suppliers to them, and they decided that they just wanted to buy the company. It would make it simpler for us to work together in the most collaborative way possible. And that BN Ranch is now a part of Blue Apron and part of the supply chain, and I'm a full-time employee of that company.
Who owns Nyman Ranch at this point?
Nyman Ranch is owned by Perdue, which is one of the larger poultry companies in the U.S. They own the Coleman name as well as Nyman Ranch, and Perdue is their primary name, and it's a very large company. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with it. It's actually in pretty good hands. I'm much more comfortable with them owning it than some of the venture people that got involved between my ownership and my partnership and the ownership that I was involved with and Perdue transaction, which occurred a couple of years ago.
What advice do you have for entrepreneurs in perhaps any business, but certainly in the food business, because you've been through a lot of adventures? Do you have some advice you could share with them?
Well, the most important thing, and this is wisdom that I got just after I needed it, is that even if you dilute the ownership by taking in outside money and partnerships, control of the ethos and the brand and what the company stands for is essential. And you need to be able to maintain that, even though you may not have majority control from an investment point of view. So control of the whatever business you're in and control of the key attributes and or the ethos of the company broadly described is essential to long-term peace of mind and maintaining the mission and goals that your startup company was founded upon.
Also, I continue to be confounded by people in the meat industry, and maybe it's done on purpose by the big players. But it seems like it goes from this kind of almost predictable cycle from shortage to overages, and people always chasing the wrong side of the curve. Can you comment on that?
I think this is the farmer's fault, farmers and ranchers. Even though there's, you know, legions of data supporting the cyclical nature of all these markets, anytime there's a fast market, usually driven by undersupply, sometimes by maybe a disease outbreak or some change in trade policy, as we're experiencing now. But, you know, if the prices are high, farmers jump in. If the prices are low, farmers liquidate. And those are the kind of inexorable forces in the market at work with, you know, very predictable outcomes. So the swings in the market are much less volatile in cattle because it takes many years to get in and out because the growth cycle of the animal is so much longer versus the other extreme, which would be chickens at 42 days, roughly the birds from hatching to slaughter are ready to be sold and converted to meat. So the poultry market and the pigs are quite short as well with a short gestation and maturing at 5 to 6 months. So it doesn't take long to ramp up your production of hogs. Certainly doesn't take long in chickens. And anytime there's a fast market or a strong market, production gets turned up, and very shortly thereafter, there's going to be oversupply. It's as predictable as taxes and death.
It's amazing how many farmers end up on the wrong side of that curve.
Yeah, well, buy low and sell high if you can. That's not always easy. But, you know, it's just the way it is. As the ownership of production is more and more concentrated in, you know, corporate hands of people that are running farms and ranches from spreadsheets as opposed to day-to-day out there on the land or with the animals, there are some people that are making prudent decisions. You know, so they're reducing their numbers when the market's really strong, and then waiting for the market to collapse, and then they're buying back in and expanding in a timely manner. So there are people that are succeeding on that level, but they're managerial spreadsheet operators more likely than they are farmers that have their hands in the dirt or stewarding animals through their lives.
So there continues to be a concentration of power, you might say, in this industry as well.
Yes, and I think this is really the most scary things that's happening in our food system is just this industrialization of everything and scaling everything and all purchasing decisions being driven by price as opposed to, you know, the more important underlying qualities or attributes people are being sold as food.
So let's go back to that 90s visit to the Bill Nyman Pig Ranch. You had a, you know, with associated farmers that were extremely conscientious, knew the name of every one of their pigs. So describe what that farm looked like as opposed to current day industrial farms.
Yeah. Well, they differ greatly. The farms that made up the Nyman Ranch supply chain at that time were kind of the sensible farmers that were on the rural landscape all the way up to and through World War II and probably up until 1960, where pigs were raised outdoors. They have gone in and out of a barn or some portable shelters or something that served them well enough to get them out of the cold wind and snowy blizzards and whatnot. Other than that, they would thrive outdoors. And pig farmers were a pretty unique group of people because, one, they really loved the animals and found them to be extremely interesting and adaptable. And two, it didn't require nearly as much capital expenditures or structures as raising cattle did. And pigs are just a lot of fun. And there was always a good market for hogs, a sensible, reasonable market. So most pigs were, you know, kept on the side of a barn or near the barn or some were out in pasture in portable huts, and people primarily fed them corn and soybean, or there was, you know, obviously a lot of byproducts that were wonderful and affordable sources of good food for pigs, pigs being omnivores. And there were opportunity there. But without exception, maybe a few exceptions, the pigs always had unfettered access to the outdoors where they could get in the dirt, in the sun, breathe fresh air. And then, you know, with the post-World War II, with the munitions industry converting to fertilizer production and dramatically increased yields per farm on corn and soybean or the equivalent, and all government policy, especially in agriculture, leading to supporting creation of huge surpluses of grains and commodities in order to compete with the Soviets, that the opportunity to bring large numbers of animals into a confined small area and bring feed to them was very attractive, both from a cost of production point of view, because the surpluses of grain and federally supports made corn and soybean or the equivalent very cheap. In fact, in the animal feeding industry, it was considered free. So then everything was about labor and breeding, and those were your costs. And the farmers and ranchers really took advantage of that. Now, couple that with the invention of antibiotics, beginning with penicillin, and the discovery that if you feed animals minute doses of penicillin every day, or other families of antibiotics that soon came on the landscape, you could really crowd animals together. And if you put some capital structures up, you could raise an awful lot of animals with one or two people on the farm and kept them in confinement, not needing to let them outside or have fresh air. And they're generally, pig enterprises were living over their manure in a really a heinous way of raising animals, although it was a very successful business model and remained so up until very recently. It still is, but as consciousness in the marketplace grows and fewer people are accepting of that total confinement, indoor raised torturing of animals, there's more and more pressure to return to the more sensible ways of 1960s and before, where pigs were allowed to roam outside and thrive and do what pigs do without the need for man-made compounds to keep them alive. So today, I would say what it looks like if you were to fly over, able to see what's going on in the landscape, that 95 to 98% of pigs are raised in total confinement in buildings without any windows or anything but mechanical ventilation. And they're born in there, and when they leave, they go to the slaughterhouse, and they've never breathed fresh air or felt the sun on their back. That is the prevailing paradigm today throughout the world. And it's not pretty, and I believe that if people have the opportunity to be inside those barns and observe how the pigs are being tortured, they probably would eat a lot less pork. And pigs are as smart as dogs, perhaps smarter, probably smarter than my dogs. And the idea that my dogs are big, so they don't have to be smart, but the idea that you can keep an intelligent animal in a cage that they can't turn around and all they can do is get up and down and think that's okay for their 2 or 3 years of their life is really, it's just beyond my ability to comprehend. So it's ugly and it's unnecessary and it's the way of the world though today.
So Bill, I think another important point to mention is in those 90s, we didn't have to worry about that feed being GMO corn or soybeans. For the most part, there wasn't nearly as much around. And then also a lot of those farmers raised their own crops to feed the pigs, didn't they?
Yes. Well, the primary driver in the hog industry up until the large confinement operations was to add margin. That means to add value to the corn and soybean that farmers were growing. So they could add value to it by, instead of sending it and shipping it and selling it to the elevator, they could keep it, whether they stored it in town or on their farm, feed it to hogs, and add value to the crops that they were growing. And the same thing could be was said for broilers or grain finishing beef. That was the genesis of the animal feeding industry. Again, to add margin to crops that were grown, commodity crops, whether it's corn, soybean, barley, wheat, milo, sorghum, depending what geography you're in. Those concentrated energy, those plants, made great livestock feed. And instead of selling them as bulk commodities on the market, you could sell them for more if you were able to put it through animals and had the labor and facilities to operate those systems.
Well, your friend and mine, Francois Vecchio, who I also interviewed as part of the Soleri Food Series, talked about in Switzerland, you know, almost every dairy had some pigs because there was an excess of whey, and which is a very nutritious food for the pigs and made for some delicious meat.
Yep. That was not unusual at all in the 40s and 50s. In fact, in the area that I live in now, which was a dairy area serving San Francisco, because they couldn't get the fluid milk to the city, this was before the bridges, in the 19th century, that they made butter, and the skim milk, just when they separated the cream from the milk, the skim milk went right down a pipe into the pig pen. And same thing with the cheese factories, you know, had whey as a waste product. And, it, you know, they didn't do anything. It just went right into the trough, and pigs lived on that and did wonderfully. There's nothing better than milk-fed pigs.
So when I was there at that pig farm, there were
sorry for interrupting, but that was before, strangely enough, where people got fat phobic and were paying just as much for skim milk. You know, now that skim milk, which was a waste and byproduct from the production of butter or butter, is now something that fat phobic people, you know, purchase for the same price as whole milk, which is one of the real absurdities in the marketplace. So that paradigm shift in how consumers purchase dairy products, from whole milk to 2% to 1% to skim, it was the demise of that, feeding milk to pigs, unfortunately. Excuse me, go ahead.
I remember at that farm looking out, and here's these little huts. It's like little dome huts, and there's pigs with their little families, mothers with their families, and spread out across a field with a lot of space between them. And here the pigs are basically out grazing and rutting and doing all that, doing what they do naturally. It was, and I asked you, I said, this seems to be a less expensive way to raise pigs than the confined, you know, force feeding. And you said, yeah, it is. I said, well, how come more people don't do it? Now, I guess it's not an intense use of land, but it is a very economical way to raise pigs, is it not?
Well, not only that, it's regenerative in terms of use of the soil. But, of course, the key factor in that is labor. So there's a considerable amount of labor required to raise the pigs outdoors versus a capital-intensive factory where one person on a 9-to-5 basis can manage a lot of pigs. But, you know, it does come down to inputs. And the cash inputs into raising pigs outdoors is far less than in a capital-intensive structure. But the key factor, and it's a variable cost, is the labor. And most farmers, especially family farmers with families, don't charge enough for their labor, maybe because where they're living, they're not as if they can hang out a shingle and charge $300 an hour to consult or be an attorney or whatever. So they have a different economy, and they can make a couple bucks an hour by going to the pig barn or moving some pigs around, or they will do that. And that's an opportunity for them. But the important thing for me, Harry, and we haven't even dealt with it, that if you understand the nature of a pig, and remember, we're raising these animals so we can convert them to food. And for me, if it doesn't taste great, it doesn't matter what the story is of how they're raised. So all of my decisions, and I think all husbandry should be driven by, what do you have to do to make it taste great without torturing the animals and the environment? And because pigs, they can't sweat, so regulating their body temperatures is much different than ours, and they depend on a layer of fat beneath their skin, and a subcutaneous fat. And that's how they cool themselves in the summer and stay warm in the winter. Well, the pigs that raised outdoors were either selected Darwinian selected or selected by farmers that can thrive in 12 months out of the year outdoors in the Midwest. So those pigs had to have fat, and there's a direct correlation between subcutaneous fat and intramuscular succulents and flavor and eating quality. So just by raising, and this is what was why Nyman Ranch is so successful, those pigs just tasted great because they had to develop the necessary fat to regulate their body temperature. Whereas if they're raised indoors in an environmentally controlled climate, they don't, you can breed that the back fat has been bred out of them because it's not valuable in the marketplace. Nobody uses lard anymore, which that was the source of it. So not only are the pigs more efficient in terms of creating red meat and not having fat and leaner, so that other kind of white meat is really just cardboard-like because it doesn't have that fat attribute, which was the key factor in eating quality. So that's, to me, from a culinary point of view, that's the most important and compelling reason to raise the pigs outdoors. And that's what you saw.
Yeah, I was going to say that not only did you raise the best-tasting beef I ever had, it also the best-tasting pork. And that was absolutely one of the reasons. And this whole idea of let's get animal fat out of our diets is probably responsible for more heart disease than any, you know, and substituted with hydrogenated fats and also vegetable oils, well, refined vegetable oils, has done more.
Fortunately, we're getting that figured out.
Right.
I mean, the data doesn't lie on that subject. That's for sure.
Of course, no, it was figured out 100 years ago. Then it was unfigured out by the AMA and FDA and industry. But what I also wanted to talk about was breeds, right? Because nowadays the commercial people—I mean, almost everywhere you look, it's less and less diversity. And isn't there one, almost like one primary breed that the commercial guys raise when it comes to pigs, but yet these individual farmers had quite a bit of diversity in breeding. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, the prevailing breed in the industry is called a modern white. You know, that describes a white pig, probably has 2 to 3 breeds make up the females, and, you know, either a two-way cross or a three-way cross. All of white pigs that are very similar, fast-growing, lean, you know, white hogs that have a lot of muscle and don't put on fat and would die if they had to live outdoors. So that's the prevailing breeds. Now, because of more general focus on culinary excellence, some of the Parkish Strait breeds have been introduced to it. Everybody's heard about Duroc and Berkshire, and those were pigs that deliver more on eating quality because they do have the ability, and certainly do on the raised outdoors, to put marbling and back fat on a pig. But even those are used in a very controlled way, and only pigs of those breeds that don't have a lot of fat, waste fat, are selected to be herd sires. So, you know, again, everything is driven by price, and the yield on an animal, the yield of red meat, is one of the key drivers in making genetic selections and breed selections. And these modern white pigs just excel on every metric that's driven to make money, and they fail on every metric necessary for good eating, because people are concerned about what they eat, and there's a market for better tasting stuff. People are kind of going back to the sensible ways and what we've learned from some of these breeds that were prevalent when pigs were raised outdoors. And I'm hopeful about that.
You use the word pig, sometimes you use the word hog. What's the difference between that? And what's a female pig called versus a male pig? And what are we eating mostly? Is it females or males?
Well, intact males would be called boars. That means they have not been castrated or neutered. What a boar pig, a male pig, at birth, if they're males, they're called boars. When they're castrated, they become barrows, B-A-R-R-O-W-S. And females are called gilts, G-I-L-T-S, at birth. And after a couple litters, they become sows. So there are probably more males than females are being converted to meat, harvested, slaughtered, however you want to characterize it. But since pigs have large litters and a couple litters a year and multiple births, that most of the pigs that are born end up going to meat. Probably the ratio of males to females is about 20 to 1. So that are kept for breeding. So obviously there's going to be more neutered males being raised to maturity for meat than females. But it's not 2 to 1. It's probably 55% females and 55% males and 45% females. But remember, the females as breeding sows also end up in the food chain. They do actually make the best sausage. Well, outdoor raised sows make the best sausage because they have fat and flavor, whereas the indoor raised sows are basically salvaged for red meat to mix with fat from other pigs.
And what is the word hog refer to?
I'm not sure. All I know is there's an often used cliche or axiom that pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered. And I think that has more to do with the stock market than swine husbandry. But pigs are growing, and as they get closer to maturity, they're most often spoken of as hogs.
So hogs can be male or female.
Yeah,
right.
They can be male or female. When you talk about your breeding herd, you'll usually talk about sows and boars and gilts as opposed to pigs or hogs.
How does a farmer decide which hog he's going to keep for breeding? Which male boar he's going to keep for breeding? What does he look for?
Well, there's a lot of variables in that. But first thing you do is look at your herd and what do you need to improve? Do they have to have more milk? Do they have to have larger litters? Do they have to have more leg underneath them? Do they have to have more stretch along the back? So once you learn what you should be focusing on to improve, then you would look for a mother pig to have significant litter size, as a good average number of pigs per litter. She's a good mother, and she's got stretch along the back, or she's got a good temperament. She grows fast. Her offspring, if you're fortunate to get data regarding the meat quality of her offspring, those are the kind of things that one would look at. Now, if the pigs are too lean, then you'd want to select a boar that has traits that may make them fatter. If the females don't have a lot of milk and have trouble weaning large litters that are heavy, then you want to select your boars, your males, whose mothers were good milkers. So it's mothering and meat quality are probably the two most important traits, and they may be in conflict. But the thing to do is to focus on what you need at that moment as opposed to a single trait forever. Like the dairy guys, for example, this may be helpful, everything was driven by the number of pounds of milk a cow would produce in a dairy cow. And that's the only thing that mattered, so they were selected for a single purpose. That's the jargon on that. And what you end up with is Holstein Friesian cows that can produce a huge amount of milk, but they can barely give birth to their own offspring. They can't live outdoors anymore, so all they can do is produce a lot of milk, and it requires a lot of feed and a lot of attention and tender loving care to have them survive. Whereas if those cattle were turned out and had to have a calf on their own, and if they didn't come in with a calf, they went to the slaughterhouse in the same way that beef cattle were selected, you'd probably have less milk production, but cows would last longer. Dairy cows would last longer. There'd be fewer disease problems. There'd be fewer calving problems and so on. But that's not the case.
And a last question about pigs. When the sows are in heat, do you have to be careful to keep the boars separated, or they'll start fighting, same way a lot of males do?
Well, I'm too old to remember what that was like, but it's not unique to four-legged animals. So you get a bunch of young men around anything that's in heat, you're going to have a struggle. So in modern facilities, boars are kept. Well, first of all, most of it's done by artificial insemination these days. But because the pigs are in confinement, you'll have a boar that walks up and down the aisle, or you'll know when a pig is in heat. She'll come into heat 3 days after she weans your litter, and that's when you really want to breed them. So males fighting over females is brutal, whether they're turkeys or boars or bulls. So the management of that is almost always keep them separate, because if you allow them to determine on their own who is dominant, it wouldn't necessarily be the right pig for what you're trying to complement your females with, or to have, you know, good livestock and good meat. That's all control today.
Even for these small farmers, are they usually using artificial insemination today?
No, but the boars are not allowed to determine who's going to do the breeding. The farmer decides that, and they're usually housed separately unless they've grown up together and can live together. Or if, you know, sometimes they can do fine together if there are no females around. But as you know, all males of all species, when they're enticing females around, they behave badly.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience at this time about hogs?
Well, I think they're the most interesting animal, the most delicious animal, and really have a very important place in the food chain. And more and more, as populations become sedentary, we're not too many nomadic peoples around anymore, that you can't raise pigs if you're nomadic, they don't travel, that it's really probably it's arguable that chicken is probably the most important animal today, only because of its, you know, the numbers and the amount of being consumed. But I think the pig is probably the most wonderful animal in terms of nurturing human populations and being well adapted and delicious and incredibly interesting to raise. So I think that's enough.
So
I love them. I love raising them.
Your recommendation as a Jewish fellow, you know, that pigs are one of the greatest things, should speak fairly highly. So do you think that the Talmudic scholars got it wrong?
Well, I don't think they got it wrong. Not if you go back 5,000 or 6,000 years when the Talmud was being developed and Jews were pastoral peoples. Because you cannot be pastoral people. You cannot move across the landscape, whether you're having grazing animals or whether you're trying to avoid conflict with neighbors. If you want to be mobile and you're not a sedentary people, basically, you don't live in cities and permanent settlements, you cannot raise pigs. Pigs do not travel. And you have to grow crops to feed them. They're omnivores and basically require some sort of grain to supplement whatever else can be produced for them. So it's compelling for the preservation of the society with your ability to travel.
But a lot of the objections were around the cleanliness of the animal.
Yes.
And also things like, and certain diseases like trichinosis, for example, that they had.
Yeah.
So was there merit with that? Is that a factor today?
I think at first glance, one would consider that a problem. I mean, if you watch animals eating their manure or other animals' manure, you might be offended by that. You might think that's a health risk to people or to people consuming their meat. But all animals actually do that. The other animals manure frequently. Rarely do they eat their own. But this is a normal operating procedure in the animal kingdom. I think it's not unusual to have pigs cleaning up human latrines and whatnot. And I'm sure many generations ago when people's waste was, you know, on the landscape, pigs would eat human excrement. And I'm not sure what percentage of what we eat and the nutritive value of what we eat passes through into our droppings. It's probably a significant number, depending on what we're actually eating. And, you know, pigs and chickens do thrive on the manure of other animals. To illustrate that, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, when the cattle were put into confinement lots next to a barn and fed corn and soybean, for every 10 beef animals being fed, steer, heifer, whatever, one pig could survive and thrive on the waste. So just the amount of grain that would pass through their digestive tract could support one pig in style. So this is sort of what happens in nature. You know, it's to people who are uninitiated, it's probably offensive, and maybe, you could develop phobias around eating the animals. And yes, trichinosis could be a problem, but there are diseases equally threatening to humans in poultry and beef as well, even though they're just different. So, and of course, trichinosis was really caused by humans and what they allowed the pigs to eat. You know, they had to eat an animal that had died from trichinosis to ingest the cyst. That's the kind of the cycle of that animal. So they have to eat a dead dog that had trichinosis or something foraging around some carrion. So you could control that if you chose to. And, you know, brucellosis and tuberculosis were common in cattle of all sorts. And so that was probably more threatening to humans than trichinosis. And trichinosis could be cooked out. So in the 20th century, or certainly the 21st century, with what we know now, there's no justification for considering pork to be treif or forbidden fruit. And one should be able to make a compelling argument that it's a great source of nutrition for humans.
Well, pigs are, and our hogs are certainly revered animals around the world, especially in Far East, and incredibly versatile. Basically, the whole animal is eaten by many cultures. And again, not only did I get the most delicious beef from Bill Nyman, I got the most delicious pork. And just succulent, magnificent layer of fat on the outside and also intramuscular, beautiful color, very little purge, a remarkable eating experience thanks to you. So if you don't mind, Bill, we're going to kind of close since we had some great fun with hogs. We'll close this, and then in a future sessions, we'll come back to poultry, sheep, and goats. Does that work for you?
I would love that. Yeah, I would love that. In closing, Harry, the thought that keeps going through my mind is, and I want to share with your listeners, is whatever we were doing to produce great-tasting beef and pork and raise to the highest animal welfare standards, we weren't doing anything difficult or unusual. We were doing what any sensible farmer and animal steward has been doing for thousands and thousands of years. So nothing extraordinary was being done at Nyman Ranch. What's extraordinary is what the industry has been doing to drive costs out and make these capital-intensive operations so they could scale endlessly and somehow capture efficiencies from economies of scale. And, of course, externalizing all their costs either to the environment, torturing the pigs, or to the consumers in forms of remedial tax dollars to fix the damage, public health spending, everything. So, again, at Nyman Ranch, we weren't doing anything extraordinary except allow the animals to do what they do so well and providing them with an opportunity to really maximize their genetic potential. And the key metric for that is how they perform and how they perform on the plate. So that's a thought I'd like to leave your listeners with. So it's what the other guys are doing that's bad. What the other guys are doing, which is, you know, a problem and extraordinary. It's extraordinarily difficult and bad, as opposed to what we were doing, which was just nature's way.
Perfect summary, perfect way to close. I love you, Bill Nyman, and honored to have you as a friend.
Right back at you, Harry.
Okay, buddy.
Can't wait to talk about chickens and turkeys. Bye now.
See you.
Bye. Thank you.